WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Sheila Bowles played for the first women's basketball team at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She won the first women's basketball scholarship the next year, and she became the team's first MVP. According to the Greater Wilmington Sports Hall of Fame, it was 1989 when Hugh McManus, the then principal of Hoggard High School, hired Sheila Bowles to coach the men's varsity basketball team. It was another first, a woman hired to coach men's high school basketball, which she did successfully, leading the team to multiple conference championships and two times earning the Mideastern 4A Men's Basketball Coach of the Year Award. She was named the North Carolina High School Athletic Association Athletic Director of the Year in 2008 and was inducted into its Hall of Fame. She was also inducted into the Colonial Athletic Association Legends, the North Carolina High School Sports Hall of Fame, and the UNCW Sports Hall of Fame. She took her spot in the Greater Wilmington Sports Hall of Fame in 2011. But that's just part of her life. Today, we'll learn more about her firsts, what she's doing now, and the lessons that have served her well. She joins me now. Sheila Bowles, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us today. Let's go back to the early days. What's the first sport you remember playing? What's the first moment you remember sports touching your life?
Probably playing football in the backyard with all the neighborhood boys. Because back then, I didn't play any competitive athletics until I hit the ninth grade. There were no women's sports in junior high school or recreational sports or anything like that. So I kind of came through the neighborhood hard knocks program.
And what decade would we be talking about at this point?
We'd be talking about the 60s.
Okay, and, so the 1960s, so females weren't really considered serious athletes at that point.
No, but I was fortunate enough that I attended 71st High School in Fayetteville. And Fayetteville, North Carolina was one of the few spots across the state that did have women's athletics. We didn't have many, but we fielded a women's softball team, basketball team, tennis team. And I was on the tennis team for 1 year, but I would not call me a tennis player. Please don't tell Lenny Simpson that. But I had the good fortune to be able to play basketball all 4 years at 71st. So that was a very pivotal thing in my life.
So your family had moved to Fayetteville by the time you were in first grade, and you're saying that's where you spent really the rest of your childhood. What was Fayetteville like at that point?
You know, it was... It was tough because it was during the Vietnam War, and I had lots of friends with, at that point, not so many mothers were involved in service at that point, but lots of fathers. And so there was some bad stories and, kids and friends that had fathers that would do multiple tours in Vietnam, and course, when they're gone, it's a scary time. So, but certainly, even not being military, it taught me a lot of life lessons, and certainly gave me a great appreciation for the military.
And your dad was in the military for a couple of years, wasn't he?
Yes, he was in the military when I was born, Fort Jackson, South Carolina. He was drafted during the Korean War. But only for 2 years, but he did serve, yes.
And then he started his own business, but he had an athletic background too, didn't he?
He did. He played football at Appalachian State and played semi-pro baseball for the Brooklyn Dodgers. But football kind of ended that career because of a shoulder separation, and he was a pitcher. But lots of people in where he grew up, they have told me that he was a outstanding athlete.
So you had some of your own opportunities when you were in school yourself in Fayetteville, but also in the 1960s, since that wasn't really a thing that a lot of females did, how did your parents feel about your intense interest in sports?
They were 100% behind me. They never missed a game, not in high school, very, very few in college. They would travel to the ends of the earth to watch me play and be supportive. So that could not have been any better. And honestly, and I know we might be getting off track here, but when I left high school, I never really thought I'd play again. And it was just a whim when I came to UNCW and went to register for classes that there was a sign in Hanover Hall that read Women's Athletic Interest Meeting. And I attended that meeting. And from that meeting, it was decided that we would have women's basketball. So in the fall of 1973, UNCW had their first women's basketball team.
What had you planned to do at UNCW?
I had planned to go on the physical therapy. And that lasted a semester. I couldn't deny what I wanted to do. I definitely wanted to be a physical education teacher, and I wanted to coach.
So going back to your parents' incredible support of your interests, even when it may not have been traditional or practical, why do you think they weren't afraid of your interests? I mean, it would be completely understandable for parents in the 1960s to say, well, she's our girl. We want her to do something that we know will be
Inert.
safe. What? So how, I mean, that took some courage, didn't it, for them to be supportive of that?
Just think my mom and dad always had the mindset that a couple of things that I could always be whatever I wanted to be as long as I paid the price and not to miss opportunities, but I don't know, they just had a mindset that the only thing that they required of me is they definitely wanted me to have a higher level education than just high school. It could have been an associate's degree. It could have been a college degree. I really didn't, but that was something they definitely wanted for me. My grandmothers were both my grandfathers died early, and anyway, I think they saw single moms that struggled that support a family, and they just wanted me to be able to take care of myself, and whatever that was, they were all for it.
And they were also supportive of your interest in music. Tell us about that.
Okay, so music was more of a determination than it was a talent, that's for sure. But I got a lot of mileage out of it. I started playing guitar when I was 10, and ended up playing in a rock band in Fayetteville called the Vandals. And I also played in a Christian rock band, the Good News Singers of Fayetteville, where there were 150 singers and five musicians, and we got to do a lot of things. We went to Canada 3 times and went to Italy for 3 weeks and played a lot of churches in southeastern North Carolina. Here in Wilmington also, we went to Wesley Memorial Methodist when I was in high school, and that's where I attend church now. But music led me to a lot of opportunities. Even though I wasn't that talented, I sure got a lot of mileage out of it.
Do you still have your guitar?
I have five.
And you still play.
I pick it up and pick it every now and then, but I really don't play anymore. But anyway.
So going back to 1973, when you transferred to UNCW, first of all, why did you pick that school?
Well, I really thought I was going to end up at NC State or Appalachian State. But I came down to visit one of my best friends from high school. She was staying down here with her aunt and uncle, and she was dating a guy who ended up being her husband. And I came down to Wilmington, and for the first time ever, I saw UNCW. I didn't even know it existed. And I've always been a beach girl. My parents were brought up in the mountains, and my brother's a mountain guy, but I was definitely a beach girl. And, anyway, yeah, just like it happened so fast, I just decided, okay, I'm going to apply. And I want to come to Wilmington. And I did, and I got accepted, and then kind of the rest is history.
And so you had planned to major in physical therapy, and then you just saw a sign somewhere about women's basketball. Tell us about that moment.
I went to register for classes. It was the first day you go in, used to everybody register for classes in Hanover Hall, which is the old gymnasium. And I walked in and saw that sign, and I was like, in my mind, I was just like, wonder what this is about. You know, I'm curious. And, it just ended up to be another opportunity and another blessing that just fell in my lap.
Which is the way you seem to look at a lot of your life. It's interesting. And we're going to talk more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Sports Hall of Famer Sheila Bowles. And when we come back from this break, we'll find out why she looks at everything as an opportunity instead of limitations, and what makes a good coach. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with Sheila Bowles, the first woman to coach a men's high school varsity basketball team in North Carolina and UNCW's first female basketball player on scholarship, as well as its first MVP. Sheila Bowles, just before we went to break, you said when you saw that sign at UNCW about interest in a women's basketball team, you talk about it as another opportunity that popped up instead of a limitation, because there hadn't been a basketball team or women weren't considered serious athletes. You seem to view a lot of opportunities in your life as doors opening instead of what wasn't available. How do you think that view has affected the actual opportunities that have come your way?
It's just afforded me to do so many things. And what are the chances that I graduate from high school, there's no women's sports, and then I come to UNCW and they have their first women's team and I get to play. And then the second year we have our first women's volleyball team and I get to play on that too. And then I get to do what I knew what I always wanted to do as coach and teach physical education. And just, I don't know, I think my mom and dad taught me one thing is that, you know, recognize opportunity. I think that's a lot of things that maybe a lot of young people, you're young, if you don't have anybody putting that in front of your face, I don't know if you see things as an opportunity, but my mom and dad did that for me. And it has given me, what are the chances that I end up coaching men's basketball at a 4A high school when I didn't even think I was going to play athletics again, graduate from high school. And I think Althea Gibson, Lenny would be proud of me for saying, I think Althea Gibson is the one that says, you don't get anywhere without other people.
And I have just had so many people in my life that have opened a door for me.
And the only thing I can say is I grabbed it, because I remember my dad saying one time, if you don't grab that opportunity, you might not get it again.
Mm-hmm. And you started your teaching and coaching career in 1977. How did that begin?
At Pinderlee Junior High School in Pender County. And I coached three sports, and I loved it. I loved it. We didn't have any heat in the gym. It got so cold up there that winter it was terrible, but the water in the toilets froze. There were birds that would fly into the locker room, but those kids didn't care. They put on their gloves and hat, and they played like crazy. It was a great experience. So my career actually started at Pinderlee Junior High School in Pender County.
And at what point did you get that call from Hugh McManus, principal of Hoggard High School at the time? How did that come up?
Well, you know, I was teaching at Trask, where Hugh McManus was principal. And during that time, and I'm not going to get the years exactly right, but I think around 1983, I got a call from Bill Hardy over at Laney asking me if I wanted to coach the women's basketball team at Laney. And so I went to Hugh and asked him if he minded. He said no. So I actually taught at Trask, coached everything over there, and also coached the women's team at Laney. And then about 2 years later, Hugh calls me over the summer and says, I want to run something by you. He said, how would you feel about being the boys basketball coach at Trask and athletic director at Trask? And I was like, wow, I'm giving up the girls varsity team to come back and coach boys. But it's something that had always intrigued me. The speed of the game, playing above the rim, just, I don't know. So I did it. I came back to Trask and I coached the boys basketball team. And I think there's a lot of people still around town that would tell you that no coach should ever have that much talent, because it was the most talented ninth grade basketball team I had ever seen in my life and still have ever seen in my life. And all these boys ended up at Laney. Kevin Whitted and Timmy Robinson, David Dempsey, Alton Huff. I could go on. So I did that for 2 years. I coached the boys team at Trask and had some phenomenal success. And then fast forward, Hugh goes to, once we became middle school, Hugh became principal at Hoggard High School, and he calls me in the fall to ask me, would I be interested in coming to Hoggard? And I'm like, what am I going to coach? He said, JV boys basketball. I said, I'm coming. So I go to Hoggard and I coach JV boys basketball and JV girls softball. And the following year, the men's varsity basketball job becomes available. And they do a national search. And they offer it to a guy by the name of Art Pascal. I'll say that because Art's real, his family's pretty well known around here. His dad was superintendent of schools in Columbus County, and Art played basketball at UNCW. We knew each other. And he was a head coach at New Bern High School at the time. And so that's who Hugh hires as. And so Art calls me, we're going to meet at Jimbo's on a Saturday morning because he still wants me to coach JV boys basketball, and we're going to talk about things. Well, it ends up New Bern just could not let him go, so he ends up not coming to Hoggard. And so they go and offer the job to a guy by the name of James Day, who played at Carolina and had won two state championships at Lexington High School. And long story short, he ended up not taking it either. So I became third choice.
Oh.
And so, because Hugh really didn't think the community was ready for a woman to become a varsity. You know, we had already made some waves with me being a JV boys basketball coach. And he just didn't know if the community was ready for a woman to become the varsity coach.
Well, tell us about those waves. What was that like when you first started working with a boys team? Do you remember the pushback, and how did you deal with it?
You know what? I really don't remember that pushback at Trask. I think it's because, you know, at that time, Larry Bolin, and we had a guy by the name of D. Sasser, but we were basically a three-person department coaching everything. And I even helped out with football for 5 years with Larry Bolin. That's how, you know, we all helped each other. So I think those boys were very receptive of me, and the parents were too. And I know I probably had my naysayers out there, but I also had a lot of support. And but when it came down, when the two people had turned it down, Hugh decided, he calls me on a Saturday morning and says, "Do you want to apply?" And I was like, "Do you want me to apply?" And he's like, "Do you want to apply?" And I'm like, "Yes, I want to apply." And anyway, so I apply, and I'm interviewed by a panel of five men. And I can remember the last thing that I had told them. I had been coaching for 13 years, and I had earned the right to fail. And if I did not get the job done within 3 years, they needed to fire me. And but I had earned the right to have that opportunity. But long story short, it went before the board, and it was a 4-3 vote in my favor, and I got the job.
How is it different coaching a team of men or a team of women? What are the gender differences for you as a coach?
You know, there's so many factors you could go into as far as the difference, but in a lot of ways, it's all exactly the same. You know, I think the biggest thing for players, men or women, is the first thing they got to know about their coach is their coach cares about them as a person more than they do care about them as an athlete. And as long as they know that you care about them, and sometimes, you know, caring is not always giving them what they want and saying what they want to hear. But they figure that out. They know that. And so in so many ways, there's no difference. The men are a little taller and a little stronger and jump above the rim, but they're also a lot more hard-headed. Women coaching women, they would literally do exactly what you tell them to do. The men kind of ad-lib a little bit, but that's okay.
Great. How do you know when you need to come down hard on an athlete and when you need to kind of shore that athlete's self-esteem up? How do you figure that out?
Well, there's certainly times that you don't always get it right, because you don't. I think two big experiences in my life was my first year in Wilmington, my first full summer. I worked for the YMCA, and it was a program that was actually, I think, sponsored by the United Way, but it was for a program that kids that were left at home during the day with no parental support. So we took them. I was stationed over at that time, Lake Forest Junior High School, over on 13th Street. And we took them to the movies, and we did arts and crafts, and we went to the fire department, the museum. And I'll never forget the first day that we took the kids to the beach. And I can remember four kids that coming across those dunes at the beach. They were 12 years old, all of them. And their eyes just got real big. And I was like, what's wrong? And they were like, "This is the first time we've ever seen the ocean." And they had lived in Wilmington their whole life, and they were 12 years old. Mm. And that was a real eye opener for me. And
And how did that change how you dealt with kids?
Yeah, I realized. And then, you know, as a coach, more so than a teacher, but honestly, I think it ought to be a requirement. But as a coach, I took those kids home. I saw where they lived. I went in their house or apartment. But you still didn't always know what was going on in their lives. And, you know, sometimes you come down on them and then find out, hey, there's something really wrong going on. And then you got to back up yourself. You know, That's the other thing. I think as a coach and as a teacher and just as a person, you got to know when to go, man, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. I had no idea this is what that person was going through. And I can remember my mom saying that 1,000 times. You treat everybody nice because you never know what they've been through that day. And that's when the first time that it really sunk in that, okay, I get it now. It took like 21 years to get it, but I get it.
You know, it's interesting because you're talking about being able to understand that you don't know someone's whole circumstance or why they do what they do. But part of your job as a coach is to get athletes to raise their standards, right? And to have discipline. And there are different philosophies on that front. Sylvia Hatchell had to leave UNC, well-known coach, 5th in career coaching victories in NCAA women's basketball. And the New York Times wrote a little bit about her being placed on leave after parents of several players complained about comments that players interpreted as racist, which of course is a separate thing from discipline. But some might argue that she felt at liberty to say some of those things to get her athletes to buckle under. And then Pat Summitt of University of Tennessee, men's basketball, also written about by the New York Times, said that if she cried when her dad spanked her, he spanked her harder. And, you know, if Pat Summitt told you to do something, then you did it. So how do you find that balance between your natural empathy and compassion for those kids and what they're grappling with and, you know, the toughness?
You know, hindsight's always 20/20. And I don't know that I always got it at time, but I think I got it more times than I missed it, thank goodness. But sometimes it would take a while. And, you know, I could be pretty dogmatic myself. You know, you could ask any of my players or people that saw me coach. I was a little bit of a schizophrenic come game time. It was I was definitely intense. I'm sure there were times overly intense. But at the same time, you know, the thing is, you know, when you're down, you can have empathy but don't have sympathy. And what that kind of means is, you know, you understand, but you gotta get back up. You gotta get back on the horse. You got to, as KEL says, swish your feet and get out. I wish I could have been a lot more like KEL because she was such a kind and general person. But
And I want to hear more about KEL because I know you have a poster of her with a lot of little wisdom nuggets on that poster. But this seems to be directly parallel to the challenges in human life, you know, what you go through in a game or on a team, and then the challenges of just life and the ups and downs. So what are some of the most important life lessons you taught your athletes for the game?
You know, I think athletics is just, it's just like going to work every day in a way. You are responsible to other people and you have a duty to be on time and to do your job, and not to let your teammates down by not showing up. And there's always going to be people in the workforce that make more money than you do. That doesn't mean they work harder than you do. It's just that they have managed to climb the ladder. And so, you know, you've got those 5 kids that start every Tuesday and Friday night, but all 15 of those players are there every day working hard. And some of them don't get the recognition that they deserve. But what they do deserve is to know how much you appreciate the fact that they're there working hard every day. And we could not succeed as a group without all 15 people. And there's just, it could go on. We could go on about this for hours. There's just so many things that athletics teach, you know, not to point the finger at each other. When something goes wrong, that's the time that you put your arms around each other and pick yourself up. I mean,
I think
hopefully, if we ever get through this pandemic, I hope that we can look back and go, hey, we should have done a better job putting our arms around each other and picking each other up through this whole thing and get through it. And have some, we all have ownership and other people depend on us to do the right thing.
Yeah, and speaking of that poster of Kay Yao, are these quotations from her? When life kicks you, let it kick you forward.
That's her. That's definitely her. She was an outstanding. I don't even know how the first time I ever met Coach Yao, but probably through a friend of mine, Jennifer Alley, who was the head coach at UNC Chapel Hill for 10 years. I got the opportunity to play golf with her and Coach Yao a couple of times. And anyway, and then at that point, I ran into her not only at coaching clinics and where she would be speaking and stuff like that. In fact, I went through a battle in 1998 of breast cancer, and I received the Courage Award from the North Carolina High School Athletic Association, presented by Kay Yao. And it was done in the Dean Dome, and my parents were there, so that will always be a special day.
Yeah, you're listening to Coastline. Sheila Bowles is my guest today, local sports Hall of Fame inductee, actually inductee into six different halls of fame and counting. After this short break, we'll find out how she believes the conversation around race has shifted since her childhood in Fayetteville, and more on what she's doing today. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Sheila Bowles has led a life smashing through barriers, although she describes it as taking the opportunities that opened to her. She was the first woman to coach a men's high school varsity basketball team in North Carolina, the first female basketball scholarship recipient at UNCW, and the first female MVP at UNCW. Sheila Bowles, just before we went to break, you were talking about what a model Coach Kay Yao is to you, and how she was actually presenting you with the Courage Award. And I want to talk more about your cancer diagnosis. You've actually had more than one. But first, going back to some of the nuggets of wisdom that you attribute to Kay Yao, like attitude is the key to success, and it's what's inside that counts, and you can't change the direction of the wind, but you can adjust your sails. You've said that one of your favorite sayings of hers, or one of the favorite things on that poster is, "I do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Tell me about that. Why is that your favorite?
I think because I heard Coach Yao say it about every time I was ever around her. It's just the truth. There has to be a higher power and a higher being to get through some of the things that we get through. And I think people that might not believe that way are certainly missing out on a great. I don't know what a great way to deal with life, because if you can put all the sorrow and all the things that go wrong in God's hands, then it's a way of relieving a lot of stress. Because now it's just, my mom felt that way. I remember I got all stressed out one night about something, and which was really, I don't even remember what it was, but my mom passed away in 2005, but I know this sounds crazy, but I actually heard my mom's voice say, put it in God's hand. And at that point, it's like somebody woke me up and it was like, okay, it's not my problem anymore. And you move on. And I think Coach Yao, she was great at that because I think her battle with cancer was about 17 years long. It was long, but you wouldn't have known it. You know, there was, of course, there's always those great years, and she did great with all her treatments till, you know, the very end. And she was just such a positive person. And I think that's because she had such a strong faith.
Tell us about your first cancer diagnosis. When did that come, and how did you deal with it?
It was in 1998. I had a lump that about the size of a pea that I knew was there. I went to get a mammogram. The mammogram came back no worrisome findings, and this had happened a couple of times. But in 1988, my mom was a breast cancer patient, and she, I guess, had been diagnosed in, I think, 1994. And I just, like, I don't know, when I went to get the mammogram and they said, let's do an ultrasound, that right there just kind of like, okay, I don't care what this comes back. I'm going to do something. It doesn't belong there. I'm going to have. So I went to Dr. Tackett, and he said, okay, let's take it out. I don't think it's anything, but we'll take it out. So we took it out, and sure enough, it was stage one. And so I was very fortunate there, but I was young. I was only 44 years old. So 33 treatments, well, two surgeries, 33 treatments of radiation, and 12 chemo treatments. And all, well, not all, but all the chemo treatments were just about through basketball season. Not really, early on. I was so fortunate the way the chemo, I would have chemo on a Wednesday, and I was fine Wednesday, I was fine Thursday, but about lunchtime on Friday, that's when I would start getting sick. So I only missed one game that year and a couple of practices, but I think having basketball and the guys on that team who were really special guys, they helped me get through that. I mean, it was, and I have great doctors. We're so fortunate here in Wilmington to have the facilities we have. We didn't have the cancer center at that time, but just great doctors. And, you know, I was very fortunate to get it early.
And then it came around again, and you were doing a different job at that point.
Yeah, that time in just 3 years ago, 2017, I noticed something odd on the other side, not even on the same side, and sure enough, it ended up being DCIS, and so had surgery and radiation, and back on the tamoxifen for 5 years. But again, just so fortunate to get it so early. There's so many things they can do. If you can catch it early, and we're so much further along in women's breast cancer right now than we were when my mom was diagnosed, and just feel really fortunate about it, and have beat it twice now.
Yeah, in 2017, the same year Hoggard High School named its gym after you.
I think that's right.
Do you remember getting the call, or what was it like to first hear that this was going to happen?
That one is really hard to talk about without crying. You know, it was like your whole career just came together in one moment. That something like this could happen to you. And then I started thinking, am I going to die? Because this didn't happen to people who are living. That's a warped sense of humor. But anyway, it was just such a shock and an honor. And all those years, all the kids,
Who told you about it?
Well, I think my first call was from Brett Queen, who is the men's coach at Hoggard right now. And Brett had been a student at Hoggard my first year at Hoggard. He did not play basketball, but he loved basketball, that's for sure. But he was my assistant. I can't even remember. I think at least 5 years, Brett was one of my assistants. And so Brett was the one that made the call to me and said, how would you feel if we named a new gymnasium after you? And then, you know, the rest is history. It's, what a beautiful facility. It's something they needed for a long, long time. It's not just the court, but it's the offices and the storage facilities and the laundry room and dance facility and classrooms and everything that goes into that. And it is to have my name on it is just an unbelievable honor.
Yeah. I have to ask, Michael Jordan played basketball at Laney High School in the late 70s up to 1981. Did you ever see him play? Did you meet him?
I did, and I did meet him. I don't know if he will remember me because I was at Trask, but his one of his junior high coaches, back then it was the whole school system was set up different. You know, we had K through six, seventh, eighth grade centers, ninth grade centers, then senior high schools, 10, 11, 12. I love that system. It was great. But anyway, when I was at Trask, Michael would come over to the boys game, and Larry Bolin was coaching at the time. And so he would sit up in the stands and watch the boys game. So I'd be over there with Larry sometimes. And so he got to talk to Michael. And just a really personable and polite young man at that time. That's what I remember about him.
Yeah. Now, going back to your upbringing in Fayetteville, we've talked about the fact that you grew up during a time when schools were just beginning to integrate. What was that like for you back then?
Well, integration would have happened in 1968 for me, which was I was entering the ninth grade, 68, 69. And Fayetteville, don't get me wrong, we had some problems, but nothing like what Wilmington was experiencing at the time, for sure. But I think there were two really big factors in that. Number one, Fayetteville being a military town. Whites and blacks had been fighting for and beside each other for a long, long time to defend our country. And that was a very respected thing. And so just the mere fact that it was a military town and things were just looked at a lot differently, I think that was a very positive and certainly a great role model for me at that time, being a 14-year-old. And then the other thing was we had an unbelievable coaching staff at 71st. Mostly men, black and white. And when it came to having any kind of trouble racially, they just didn't put up with it. None of them. And they handled it. And they handled it in a big way. And I think that was very apparent to all the students. And it was great. It was great to see that. In 1970, my sophomore year, we won the state championship in football. And I think we were never more together as a student body. And the relationships that developed, black and white, I had a teammate, Kathy McDougall, and my sophomore year. Of course, that's when you get your driver's license. And 71st was about 15 miles from my house. And so my mom, she was so thankful that I got a driver's license because she made that drive every day to pick me up from practice. So when I started driving, my friend Kathy McDougal, who was African American, and I took her home every day after practice. And it just never entered my mind. I don't know. It just, I didn't look at it. She was my teammate, and we really hung out together. And I don't know.
I think a lot of my thought process and the way I viewed things, it certainly came from my parents. And
when you think of just about your views of race and racism and how growing up in Fayetteville shaped you, what's changed for you in the last 5 decades or so? How has, you know, the fact that the national conversation is also changing and evolving? What have you
Thank
learned?
Goodness, because it sure has seemed like a long time coming. And I just think if people would, I think it ought to be a requirement to go to different neighborhoods. I mean, if you live off of Dawson Street, I think it'd be, I mean, I've been to my kids' apartments and housing, and they've been to, Lincoln Forest and Pine Valley. And that's the thing that athletics do. I mean, they just kind of mesh our society together. And if we could take athletics and put it into people's minds and say, hey, just go visit each other. Have people over for dinner. Go grab lunch. Take somebody home. See where they live. Get to know their parents. You know, they'll find out we're not so different. And it's just amazing and disappointing in a way that it's taken so long, but so grateful that it seems like finally, we're starting to get it.
Just a couple of minutes left. You have a godson who's 9 years old, and you also serve on the Board of Education for the charter school at Lake Waccamaw, the Boys and Girls Home, which is a residential facility. Can you just tell us briefly about that and your work there?
Yes. My brother has served on the board for the Boys and Girls Home for many years. And so when they decided to start a charter school on campus, he kind of volunteered me. So, I'm grateful because it's been a very, again, everything you do, you learn something, and it just reminds you of how lucky you are. But at the same time, the kids at Boys and Girls Home in North Carolina are very lucky too, because they're going to a place that the staff and people up there care so much about them. They have a great place to live, beautiful place to live, right on the lake. There's a 124-acre farm. But the school's there, and that's all. The school is what I'm involved with. And, there's a lot of kids that come there that might not have been in school for a couple of years and are behind. And staff up there does such a great job of one-on-one and catching these kids up and just serving them overtime. I'm just lucky enough to be a part of kind of overseeing that they get what they need.
And
it's been an honor to do that.
Sheila Bowles, that's our time and this edition of Coastline. What a pleasure to have you with us today. Thanks for sharing your life with us.
Oh, Rachel, thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much.
Special thanks to Coastline producer Rachel Keith, who stood by ready to explain the difference between basketball and football to me, if necessary. Technical director Ken Campbell. And today's engineer, Andrew Craig. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or find it on Apple Podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.